Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to After Things. I am Andrew Main. I am not Brian Brushwood. Brian is Brian Brushwood.
Yes, but contrary to popular opinion, I am not Justin Robert Young.
Ah, and contrary to popular opinion, I am not the Justin Robert Young from the Journey Quest, as I had to play a role, not only on the show, but because of the slow developing plot to Brian on the phone when after last week's episode, he's like, hey, man, yeah, that's crazy. It's crazy how we all just rolled with that, like, you murdering and maiming me thing. And I'm like, yeah, wow, it's a crazy life we're leading. I guess I have to lie to Brian now on the phone to preserve Journey Quest.
So both Journey Quest Brian and real life Brian just surprisingly chill about being messed around with and lied to.
It's like, I guess I now have to. Now I'm living a double life in real life. It's not just me playing a character on the end of our science podcast.
About a month and a half ago, I'm like, you know, Brian's reaction is to kill everybody when they meet them. I'm like, what if Justin kills them first?
So you had a call or you set him up with a cue to...
No, just before the first episode where the murder Justin appeared, I just get a text message that says, you're a clone and you murder everybody. I'm like, all right.
That's amazing. And what's funny is, like, I'm sitting here thinking in terms of a comedic performance, and I'm like, oh, well, you can't have two wild cards, so I guess I'm the straight man now. And so I've been rolling with it for weeks. And it's like, wow, I guess I used to have a ding dong. Not anymore.
I had a plan for that. In between the break, we were talking about the alleged hack of Apple's Face ID, or not hack of Face ID. That's that would imply they broke the encryption. But some, I think it was a Vietnamese researcher's claim. And again, the headlines are this 100 beat Face ID in the iPhone. We don't know that happened. That is what they said happened.
Well, yeah, Wired, who had apparently done invested a lot of money in masks to see if they could hack the Face ID, and were not able to, submitted a bunch of questions that they had in their process to the Vietnamese research firm. And as of press time, at least of the article that I read, the Vietnamese research firm had not gotten back to them. They were going to have their own press conference, so we can leave it to them. For when they might do that, but this to me, as of right now, until we find out more, feels a lot like the hackers beat the thumbprint ID stories that came out right after Touch ID happened, which involved, you know, 3D printing a thumbprint that you have, which would be, and even these researchers say this is far more about high-end espionage than it is about, you know, just your everyday phone cracker.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's gonna be an interesting thing unfold. And there's going to be, with you know, the right amount of effort, you know, you could, you know, break anything. And what made Face ID separate or theoretically special was that every other implementation that we'd had prior to that, to my knowledge, the one in particular on the, you know, Samsung had, be like, it's got its own face identification. You could literally fool that with a photograph of a person held up to it with another phone. You know, it was not a 3D. And this is what's supposed to make Face ID special, is it's a 3D facial recognition thing. Not easily spoofable. There was a lot of effort went into it. You know, Apple had said, hey, we've hired special effects experts to try to fool it. They didn't say if they were successful or not. That's the little, you know, then, you know, the Apple marketing, like, well, you know, I know what you're leaving me to believe, but I'm not sure if that's what happened. So we're waiting to find out. Was it that easy? Because you look at this mask and it looks really, really low tech, but they haven't told us, you know, much about it. Because if you trained it on a mask, then yeah, then a mask should be able to break it. You know, they have their questions and answers that they've answered. So were you able to use the mask to unlock iPhone immediately after freshly enrolling the real face? And they write, it does not matter whether Apple's face learns to image face, since it will not affect the truth that Apple Face ID is not an effective security measure.
That sounds like a dodge.
So, however, we knew about this learning, thus to give a more persuasive rule, we applied the strict rule of absolutely no passcode when crafting the mask. Can you explain why your hack worked, but similar attempts like Wired's failed? Because we are the leading cybersecurity firm, Winky Smile. It is quite hard to make the correct mask without certain security knowledge. We're able to trick Apple's AI, as mentioned in the writing, because we understood how their AI worked and how to bypass it. In 2008, we were the first to show that face recognition was not an effective security measure for laptops. So they don't really answer, did they train it with a mask or not or whatever. So
yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if the only rule was no passcode, but you had the active compliance of the person, you know, whose face was trained on it. It does seem, since it evolves its perception of your face over time to adjust to, you know, you grow a beard, you wear glasses and all that stuff. It seems like some amount of massaging it on a journey to where eventually both the mask and your face open it, it seems like would be possible.
Yeah, and there's another feature in there too with the iPhone with the Face ID, which is attention. It's like, are you paying attention or whatever? And that's the higher level of security. So you can say, have that. And listen, like we will all agree, like we think it's going to be spoofed. I have no doubt that it is spoofable, can be spoofed, et cetera, because it's not magic. That being said, is when somebody comes out with this sort of thing and they're evasive on a number of questions, you're like, why aren't you answering this direct question here? Like you did, because they didn't say, if it was like a regular sort of, you know, exploit, you would say, these were the settings the iPhone was in. These are the number of attempts we did. We did this here to say, hey, look, a mask unlocks it. Also, my face unlocks it. Well, did you train it on the mask and then your face? Because your face would have more, quote, liveness. So
I guess their point would be, okay, well, but this is for, you know, high-end person gets their phone stolen.
I mean,
we are able to train it on the mask. So we have the phone, we have the mask, and that's that, which, I mean, I guess if you then took it off, I mean, are you able to massage it and upload new data?
Yeah, I guarantee you their actual purpose is, and maybe they'll come out and say it, it's like, they just wanted the headline. They won it. They knew that the first to have a demo of being able to do it, they set the rules, they figured out how to get the headline, and now all over the world, this security firm will have their security for, they get to say, we're the guys who beat, blah, 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 blah. And so everything else kind of doesn't matter. And, you know, to Andrew's point, it's like, you know, yes, if you are a spy, let's maybe not rely on Face ID. But for the rest of us... Yeah. You know, then for the rest of us, it will probably keep your kids off the phone.
Here's my criticism. Not so much targeted them. And this is frustrating whenever we've had stuff comes out of a security. To our knowledge, Face ID is incredibly powerful. Touch ID is powerful. And other phones now, too. Fingerprint sensors, not just Apple. The new implementations of fingerprint sensors are great. People should be using that because it is far harder to exploit that than a passcode. Face ID is I found it to be a wonderfully powerful form of, you know, protection, et cetera. And it's not just protecting my iPhone. It's protecting data. It's protecting a lot of things. We've had part of the reason we have a huge news cycle dominated by the Russians was people who were not using best implementations of security. And now, you know, The fingerprint sensor on your iPhone, on your Android, is probably the best implementation security you have. Face ID on the iPhone is probably the best version if you're not using a strong password. When you get headlines that say, these guys broke this, not claim, not may have, when you get headlines from like The Verge that said, these guys beat the Face ID, whatever, that's irresponsible, in my opinion.
I agree that there are very, very tricky. There is a decision that you have to make if you are reporting on these kinds of security issues. And one of them is the saucy headline. There's a reason why we're talking about it, because guys in Vietnam crack Face ID is possibly technically true. With a very narrow definition, but not materially changing what we should think about when it comes to Face ID. And so in this kind of attention economy, right, you can now either choose, all right, hackers cracked, you know, little guy beats big guy, hackers crack Apple security, or you can say fraud charlatans didn't really do what they said they did.
Or you do what Wired did and say hackers, you know, yeah, say, you know.
Yeah.
I guess you just said they say they did this. And that's yeah. the responsible headline.
It is. It is. And their reporting on it I thought was really good because they yeah. went through and talked about, you know, what they've done. And yeah, but look, but even look at how everything's being ranked right now through Google.
It's like, yeah, so you get Verge top says this 100 beat Face ID, which we don't. And maybe it did, but there's not enough proof to say that at this point. NPR security firm says this happened. Wired, hackers say. Mashable, hackers fooled us. First Post, cybersecurity firm claims. CNET, Face ID supposedly got hacked. We have questions. And that's kind of like when I go look for, when you look forward to see your news sources, you got to say, okay, to whom, you know, do I think is responsibly handling this? And that's easy. There are sites I just don't go to as much because they will go for the history on the hysterical headline and they won't follow up. They don't correct themselves and you get fake news. Man, yeah. This may have happened. I mean, hats off. These guys may have totally done this and I don't want to be like, man, they couldn't have. Entirely possible. It's just that there's so many questions, yet the willingness of certain reporters to just say, nope, we'll just say it happened. Not realizing, yeah, now if you're discouraging people from using this better security measure, problem.
Yeah. I mean, look, to me, it's a valuable story for on a DIY level, sure. Right? Like yeah. to say, hey, look, this is something that you can do to understand how that AI works. If they did train it on the mask, that's interesting. I want to know how long it took for them to do it from a technological standpoint. And even them, again, in that Wired article, they said, look, this is not for the guy who just steals your phone, right? This is a higher level thing that required, you know, it required them scanning repeatedly the one dude's face with a 3D scanner. So like that is something, and then 3D printing the pieces. And so sure, $150 gets tossed around. We don't exactly know how long that took and how much access to it. To me, it as a story, it feels a lot like those Touch ID spoof stories from so many years ago.
Bri?
Yep. Nope. I'm on the same page. And the weird part is I don't even begrudge them for they did it. They won. They got the headline that everybody knew mm-hmm. was going to come, and they got there first. And to be honest, I kind of don't care how they solved it. Even if they did, you know, it is admirable as from a marketing perspective. Kudos to you. You guys recognized there was a prize waiting for you, and you ran for it. Good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, like, yeah, for them, like, yeah, I get they got, and that just, it's my problem is that the media filter.
The hysterical response on stateside.
Yeah. It's like, you know, just it's that, and then we will get other articles decrying other fake news or other stuff by these said same people. And it's like, wait a second, you know, it's hypocrisy, I tell you. And again, I mean, if they did, and if this is true, I mean, yeah, again, hats off on media. Cool. And like, if they're like, cool, that's, you know, quickly undermine some of the claims made, which we need to challenge these things.
Here's a kind of larger journalistic issue. Technology is a bigger story than there are, in my opinion, people who can responsibly and are knowledgeable enough to cover it. And you see this in a lot of stuff, science, specifically space. It's now people are more interested in it, which means more time is spent covering it. It means that they're going to get people that are just, you know, covering it in the same way that, you know, Brian would cover, you know, professional wrestling rumors.
Right.
Best he can, you know, like he try not to screw anything up, but, you know, he doesn't know much. Right. The same way that I would, like it was something that I think a lot about because I did it for a while with iTrix and I tried to educate myself as fast as possible and to do a lot of listening, you know, when I screwed stuff up and not make the same mistake twice. But I think that's an issue that is happening right now.
All right. From the bag, this is our good friend, Mr. James Harrison. So I've been a pickpocket magician for about a decade now. I've enjoyed performing this con man character. I've built my client base around it. But recently, I've been artistically inspired. I performed at Necronomicon, the Lovecraft sci-fi horror convention. It's a biannual. It happens every 2 years. Yes. Convention. And 4 years ago, I showed some tricks to the right people and they asked me if I could perform a stage version that's Lovecraft inspired. This year, I did to great success. I sent a video of it to Brian to the point that they asked me back to perform an even longer performance. My question after that long-winded backstory is this. Should I separate this performance from my already established character, make a new website, new social media, new business cards, etc., or should I give this more time to grow and see if this new character performance doesn't just die in the vine, so to speak? See you, most of you, on Hearthstone, James Harrison. Well, let's get somebody knows something about rebranding here. Anybody know anything about rebranding? Anybody rebranded here?
The way we did it with the Modern Rogue is that we incubated on the Scam School channel, but we were aware that the Scam School channel could morph over time and become something else. But ultimately, we're like, well, we want Scam School to stay Scam School, and Modern Rogue is going to launch off and be Modern Rogue. The good news is this is all pretty easy to do. You just add another page to your other show. Like when I wrote my Scam, Sasquatch, and the Supernatural lecture, I didn't immediately figure, well, do I rewrite the Bizarre Magic Show to fold all of this content in and change it? No, it was just a different product that I offered at that point forward. And it seems like you could do the same thing with this. It's like, well, you've got – it's like, we have two shows. And also, to be honest – my guess is the con man character is something that you're going to be able to use forever at most corporate events and all this other stuff, whereas the Lovecraft thing will be very, very niche. There will be some comic book conventions and stuff that are going to love it. A few people doing holiday parties, and you can ask them, like, well, tell me a bit about your audience, and if they're super alternative or whatever, then you could suggest, you're like, well, of my two shows, this one seems like the better fit, but, you know, you could do whichever one you want. I don't think this has to be as life-shattering a thing. I think it's a bit of a false binary you've given us, because you've given us either change all your materials to incorporate this new show or do nothing and wait to see if it dies on the vine. I would say none of the above. I would say it is now another product you offer, and just update your website to indicate, add one more page that describes this one product.
Yeah, and then create all the social media and the business cards and a new URL to forward to it as, the project warrants, right? If you continue to book stuff with that and it seems like something that you want to lean more into, then take those other precautions, because right now I agree with Brian. It's something that you have on there, and then if you want to, I would say, probably the and Brian, stop me if this sounds out of bounds, but like, make a new page and buy a new URL. And if you want to have that as a place that you could point people to, then tell them to go to Creepy Man, the magician.
Creepy Man, the magician .org. Yeah. I was just that late.
Exactly.
Still late on that? Still late.
I disagree.
Oh, wow.
Whoa.
No, I just wanted to say that. No, I agree. I would add one other suggestion. I 100% agree that, I think that, like, hey, this is the new me, guys. This is new me. Oh, there's no market for that. Roof. Not to say that the Necronomicon themed Lovecraft audience is a niche market.
They want you to think, is that there's only a few of them.
Yeah,
I would consider saying, like, is there a market for doing it as a live show, a stage show? And, this is a thing I've thrown out there before. Go talk to whoever owns or produces escape rooms in your area about, say, hey, I do this really cool thing, this themed act, whatever. The theme, your audience might dig it. I'm just, want to meet you. We're all entertaining people locally. There might be some sort of trade-off, whatever. Something you could do in a room there, whatever. Escape rooms, I think, are just a lot of untapped potential for magicians and people who do live entertainment.
Well, because everyone, it seems like everybody gathers and they have to wait 15 minutes till everybody's there, and then they can all go in, or maybe the rooms are occupied or their appointment isn't for a little bit. Like, there's that natural gap, that holding area that is just begging for some kind of close-up performer.
That, or just as its own venue. Just say the Tuesday night, instead of escape room, I'm going to do, my Lovecraft theme thing here, or the fact that they have an audience, they have a mailing list, they have people who are into they have a mailing list of people who are capable of getting 5 or 6 friends together to go have a cool live experience for an hour, which is just
awesome. That's one of the best thing is both the escape room and the audience is desperate for the next new anything there. The audience wants to go back and have new challenges. The escape room doesn't want to have to write all of it, and you can show up and say, hi, I would like to provide this for everybody.
Yep. So that's our take on that. So, all right, how about some Stranger Things?
Let's do picks first, and then we'll go picks. Full spoiler.
Sure.
My pick is, if you listen to the main episode, I picked Dirty John. Dirty John is the better of the two picks I'm giving today. But if you've already finished Dirty John and are looking for something else, I'm listening to Crime Town from the guys that do the Jinx with what was his name? Robert Durst? Is that what it was?
Yeah.
At any rate, this is all about Providence. Apparently, when it comes to the mafia and criminals, it goes New York, Chicago, and Providence, Rhode Island. And there's some – it's really – I finished it just last night. It's a pretty – it's a much longer – it's more like The Wire, right? It's like you learn all the little details of how everything is connected. You hear some stories from the mafia side. You hear some stories from the cop side. And you hear some stories from the kids of the mafia people and all this stuff. It's quite good. And it is a engaging and compelling – if a bit sad of a profile of Buddy Cianci, the town mayor that originally ran on a platform of anti-corruption and got into office because he was willing to take on the mob and then ultimately crawling all the way in bed with them and becoming well known as a super corrupt politician.
I remember when Andrew and I were on a lecture tour years and years ago, and we were staying with a friend in Rhode Island, and the one thing I knew from having a good friend in college that was from Providence was that Providence is mob the hell up, which bad for those who live in Providence, good if you like Italian food. So Federal Hill has one of the best just blocks of Italian food in America, and we had a really good a nice little meal. I remember that.
Yeah, just don't complain.
Yeah, no, it's fine.
It's great. It's great.
Hey, I got a pick. It is the 30 for 30 Nature Boy.
Oh, I've been seeing the ads for this. I'm really excited about it.
It was surprising because I know a lot of stories about Ric Flair. It follows Ric Flair, the professional wrestler. But man, is it a sad documentary? It is far sadder than I thought it was going to be. And ultimately, it is not so much a sports story. It is a story about, you know, a very weird profession where very weird people get into it. And ultimately, if you want to hide and revel in your pain, then like many of the performing arts, those kind of personalities are gathered around those jobs. And Ric Flair is no exception. It is... man, if you are sensitive to kind of father and son stories, this one it plays it on every level. You know, if there's one thing that the Ric Flair story has is, you know, he's somebody that felt as an adopted kid, isolated, and where it goes from there is pretty dark.
I love wrestling documentaries and stuff like that. And it's as little as I follow the sport itself, biographies and books and stuff, I read that stuff because it's an aspect of show business that I learn so much whenever I follow that. And it seems it's kind of like the concentrated sort of problems of show business.
Very much so. And it really to this day is one of those elements of show business, much like magic. I think there's a reason why magic and pro wrestling, there's so much crossover, is it kind of feels left behind in terms of being recognized. You know, pro wrestling can have big, gigantic successes as the WWE is, but still your average professional wrestler feels like, I have a character and I'm an actor and I'm a stuntman. And yet when, if I tell somebody I'm a professional wrestler, I get sneered at, you know, and there is this chip on the shoulder element to it. And that's certainly on display in that documentary.
My pick is going to be, and actually there's a couple media things I want to talk about too, because I've got a couple stories I save particularly for after things. But my media pick is, and I can't kind of get the name right, it's on BritBox, again, where I've been watching Red Dwarf, is An Adventure in Space and Time. What is that, Andrew? That's the dramatized account of how Doctor Who was brought to the screen.
Was that good?
Bryce, you are amazing how fast you are on this. Now, William Hartnell, who was the first Doctor, is played by David Bradley, who you may recognize from Harry Potter.
Awesome.
You know, he's the one with the mangy cat. And, yeah, Potter, I know you're a noob to no good. That's my Potter act impersonation. So anyhow, it's a fun sort of thing. What I didn't realize is that it was Verity. I forget her name, Verity last name. She was the producer that made, you know, she was the one that was in charge of Doctor Who. She was, you know, a breakthrough as far as a female producer, one of the first ever they had at the BBC, et cetera. So kind of pretty cool. So, Verity Lambert. Thank you. I wanted to say Lambert when I was thinking, it can't be that easy. But yeah, Verity Lambert, neat, kind of a mini little story. Brian Cox, who's always wonderful. So, breaking news here, which is going to, I think, want to talk a bit about if we got time. Here is breaking news from Variety. Lord of the Rings series moving forward at Amazon with multi-season production commitment. So there had been talked about rumors a week or so ago that Amazon was talking to the Tolkien estate about doing a Lord of the Rings series. This comes from Amazon had made a determination that said, you know, we need our Game of Thrones. We need our big epic thing. They were willing to write checks to get that. They've greenlit Ringworld and some other properties. And now that they have actually greenlit a Lord of the Rings series, which is going to explore the set Middle-earth, the television adaptation will explore new storylines preceding the Fellowship of the Ring. The deal also includes potential additional spin-off series. So it'll be produced by Amazon Studios, the Tolkien, HarperCollins, and New Line Cinema. So,
I had a realization last week because, this is on the heels of, they're going to do a new Star Wars series.
Yeah, we talked about that too. Yeah, so that's the other news we want to bring up is Netflix is going to have competition with Disney. Disney's launching its own streaming service in 2019, including a live-action Star Wars series.
Can I just make this point? I was very disappointed with Rogue One, right? And we are kind of mixed opinions on Episode 7. I'll still go see every new Star Wars movie that comes out in theaters because it's just something that I know I need to talk about. But TV right now is at such a high level that, yeah, I'll probably give it a spin. I'll be more likely to give it a spin than I would with something totally new. But ultimately, if it comes out, if the new Star Wars comes out, if a new Lord of the Rings series comes out and the reviews are hot garbage and everyone's like, meh, then I'll probably put it behind a lot of other stuff. Like TV is just such a buyer's market now. You know, IP does not, and I mean buyer's market as in viewer's choice, not necessarily buyers as in people who are buying to produce television.
Well, let me give you let's do a round of hot takes on Star Trek Discovery.
Here, I'll have the quickest one. I ain't watched it.
Yeah, neither have I.
Bryce?
No, I have not.
I haven't watched it either.
So there we go.
I mean, well, yeah. And plus all, and that is a property that a lot of people had a Star Trek sized hole in their heart, deeply wanting to be filled. I don't know anybody who has a Hobbit / Lord of the Rings sized hole in their hearts that this is finally going to satisfy.
Let me say this. Justin and I spent more time talking about a new Star Trek television show than the actual amount of hours the new Star Trek show fills. Mm-hmm. Just a side note. So, we had an. I'm going to bring my bridge to your point. So there was an excitement that we had for like, oh yeah, I want to see this, and like, oh, it's streaming. I know the streaming sort of handicap thing. You know, streaming like, oh, it's available there, or whatever. It's like, you know, pay the $15 for the month and try it and see if I like it, and then cancel it, whatever. That wasn't that was a roadblock for it. But the reason the show existed was to push the streaming service. It's not like, oh, we got Star Trek, where do we go? It's no, we got a streaming service. What's a high profile brand name that we can put on there to get it? That's the only reason it existed, was because of the streaming service. But the only thing, I don't know a single person that saw it. I know zero people that saw it. The only thing I know about it was from reading reviews, which were tepid at best. And anyhow, to the point of Lord of the Rings, Brian, like, I'll say that, like, I love the trilogy, the first trilogy, love the Peter Jackson trilogy. I love the extended editions. I love to rewatch it. If they're going to do some really cool stories in Middle Earth of that level, and it's the same people involved with, not necessarily Jackson, whatever, but I'm into it. But if it's, like Justin says, if it's a meh response, if it's anything other than this is great, yeah, I'm not going to watch it.
Yep.
Isn't that crazy, though? Because I feel like I still eventually saw, like, I mean, they outpaced my interest in Lord of the Rings movies by, like, two movies, and I still wound up seeing all of them, right?
I couldn't finish The Hobbit. I still have yet to finish the last Hobbit movie.
I haven't seen any of the Hobbit movies.
Well, that was a problem there, because the Hobbit movies were I've said this before, when The Hobbit was announced and Game of Thrones was already like season two or season three, was like, we're talking about, like, I'd never thought I'd say more excited about the next season of HBO's Game of Thrones than I would be about a new trip to Peter Jackson's Middle Earth. But that was the truth. You know, it was just that, like, you're like, yeah. So we'll see.
But, you know, we'll see. I find it so interesting now that television and movies have kind of diverged a little bit for me, that for movies, that the IP will still get me in the theater. For TV, I mean, show me what you got.
Yeah, but even still, like, I still don't have my tickets for Jedi, and I'm sure it's going to be great. It's Rian Johnson, but I just, you know, I so burned on Rogue One, that it made it hard for me to jump through all the hoops to pre-order tickets.
So. Yeah.
I'm cautiously optimistic.
So you heard the news about Rian Johnson, though. His next project
is three more Star Wars movies with
his
the new
trilogy. Own Star Wars movies.
I'll tell you what, man. I've heard that song before. I've heard new stuff. Definitely not about the first trilogy. Definitely new. Psych. It's really a prequel. You know, we'll see.
Brian, you are the scalded dog on that promise specifically when it comes.
Well, especially
to this
stuff. It's the one promise that I wanted. Forever. Like, if you told me before any of the new movies came out that Rian Johnson would do a completely brand new trilogy having nothing to do with the original series, knowing how much I deeply love Looper and a bunch of his other stuff, I would have lost my mind. But having heard it after being lied to for 5 years straight, I'm just a little more tempered in my response.
Well, I mean, that would be Rogue One, right? That is the Rogue One response, because Rogue One was the first one that was like, no, we'll do new characters that don't have anything to do with this other stuff, and then was a nostalgia wank.
Yep. That's certainly the biggest betrayal. Well, and also I went in, you know, with Force Awakens, you know, thinking, hey, this would be great. It definitely won't just be a remake of A New Hope with a different skin. Oh, wait, no, it's definitely just a remake of A New Hope with a different skin, which is fine. And I understood and I apologized for it because, you know, it's like we have to send a message to let people know that they're riding the ship, that this is not going to be like the prequels, this is going to be like the originals. I understood that and forgave it, even though I was disappointed. And then But then they lured with the right promise, and I got full on suckered. I got Lucy footballed.
Sorry. So sorry. What do you want to see out of a Marvel television show? Star Wars. Star Wars.
Out of a television show?
Yeah.
Literally new stories that are
competent writing.
Yeah.
I want compelling characters that I can relate to. It wouldn't help to, or wouldn't hurt to have a protagonist who I could invest my hopes and dreams and see whether they struggle and eventually succeed. I don't know. So, I mean, like, I just, I want, like, there's a million different amazing television shows on. Like, there are shows on right now that I am ashamed that I have not caught up on. Now I have the opposite problem. There's no longer what are you watching on TV. There's why haven't I caught up on Mr. Robot, right? Like, there's so much just amazing stuff that is happening that I literally just don't have time if you are going to, like, fart in my face for three episodes. I'm done. I'm out. I used to be like, well, you know, let's get – usually it's five episodes before a show catches its footing. No. Three. If you're not – if it's one, two, three, that's enough for me if you have not caught my interest. Or I have somebody in my ear saying, this is the most amazing thing. You have to stick it out.
Yeah. You know, what I thought sounded really cool was back when Lucas was talking about doing the TV show, which was going to be Star Wars Underworld, which was kind of like the idea of sort of like the criminal element on Coruscant, whatever. And that sounded really cool. And that was like that IP ended up in, like, I think the video game that never got released, et cetera. But it was a really, really cool premise for that. And that's the one where they actually brought in Ronald D. Moore as one of the people to work on writing. And I'd heard Josh Friedman attached to it, et cetera. Some really great writers going on with it. But interesting thing. I have a theory as to why Lucas got very, very bitter about the Disney acquisition. And do you remember? So the Disney bought Star Wars at the end of, like, in December 2012. Uh-huh. And there was this, you know, what motivated him to sell, et cetera, blah, blah, blah. Do you remember how they were going to release all of the Star Wars movies in 3D?
Yeah, that's right. They only got as far as doing The Phantom Menace, and it did so poorly that they're all like, yeah, maybe not, maybe not.
Phantom Menace came out in February of 2012, did about $45 million, which you have to figure in people. People hear like, oh, $45 million sounds great. Well, compared to what? Compared to what your spend was. And so half that, like, and you hear like, oh, this movie made $100 million this weekend. Well, the theater got half that, you know, and then there's all sorts of other. So it's not like, oh, they just shoveled $100 million in the studio's pockets. Like, theaters aren't actually charities. So, you know, you figure maybe half that was what it made was actually its revenue was like $23 million. You figure out the cost of the transformations, the what it cost of conversions, marketing, all that, which doubles those all sorts of stuff. So, yeah, that was not a good return. And Lucas's plan was he was going to use one to finance the release of the next, to the next, to the next, the next. So, yeah, Phantom Menace comes out in 3D. Does not do well at all. December, Lucas sells Star Wars to Disney for $4 billion. Now, Lucas had tried to get a TV show off the ground, like we just talked about, where he said, we have like 100 episodes written. Problem was, you sound like great. Sounds like a great idea. Lucas wanted a network to commit to all 100 episodes.
Good luck with that.
Which, if you're talking in an era where you're spending, you know, $10 to $15 million for really high, and Lucas would probably say, we can do it for four or five. It didn't quite work out on your other stuff. But if you're still talking a $10 million per episode thing, you're asking somebody to make a $1 billion commitment. So that's why we didn't get the TV show, is because he wasn't willing to say, like, let's do 10 episodes or a season, whatever. He'd spent a lot of money, too, on it, and he wanted, like, this. So he goes and sells Star Wars to Disney for $4 billion. Disney goes in, quickly turns that. You look at how fast Disney turned that IP around. That was actually pretty fast. Rogue One grosses $2 billion, which may be a billion profit, whatever, to Disney. You factor in all of the – you factor in what they got, the marketing tie-ins, all that other stuff, probably about $1 billion. Then you add in all of the merchandising, okay? Disney probably made that back in 18 to 24 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So you're Lucas going, I could have asked for another billion or $2 billion. Lucas realized – he probably could have got another couple $1 billion out of Disney for that property, because Disney ran the numbers. Disney knew what they could get out of that.
Yeah, but also, here's the thing. If they were seeing decreasing returns on investment, and when you are trapped in the bubble of who you are, it's you can't – like – the only way for him to realize he could have gotten more billions of dollars is for him to run the numbers the same way Disney is running the numbers. And if he ran the numbers the way Disney ran the numbers, he wouldn't have been releasing failure after derivative crap for the last 5 years. So in other words, like there was no way he could have known that, because that's the only reason that Disney offered him that money is because they could see what he couldn't.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. He undervalued his own IP because, well, you know, I don't know if there's really this interest in it because Phantom Menace, and it was hard to get. No network wanted to go buy this. And it's like, it's just that, you know, that's the problem, is that he absolutely undervalued the IP and didn't, you know, but I don't think he realizes that why did it do so well for Disney? I don't think he still even appreciates the fact of why it did so well, because now he's saying, I could have just hired Abrams to have done it, and I would have had this thing. So, again, maybe. He gave us an awesome thing. Star Wars TV show. Ladies and gentlemen, Stranger Things.
So I was
Spoilers.
I was the late man. Every time, both on the show and in private phone calls, these two would start to talk about Stranger Things, and I would go, meh, meh, meh. I'd make that noise. Now we have all seen it. Who wants to start?
We gave the reviews. My big complaints are it's slow and meandering. There's random substitutions to plug in for a missing 11. 11, I think this entire season just spent too much time in the woods. She spent the entire gap in between season 1 and season 2 in the woods, and then she ran off and spent more time in the woods, trying to figure out who she is or whatever. That whole thing in Chicago where she goes and joins and becomes, you know, the dark version of herself or whatever, I feel like that might have been better. Somebody suggested, what if she was gone and then she just shows up looking super goth and badass, and then we went back and found out about, you know, why does she look that way? What did we miss from her story? That might have gone over better than the way they did it, which is showing everything linearly, where it's like she goes off and we have to watch her meander around and figure out what she doesn't want to be and then showing up.
Yeah, I think, Brian, structurally that would have added more drama to it. I just thought that whole side story, the Pittsburgh thing or whatever, was just didn't. It just felt like it was in a less good show. It didn't feel like it wasn't good of a show. Part of what I loved about Stranger Things, and I've watched this first season like 2 or 3 times now, is it's efficient. It's only 8 episodes. It feels like a lot more because so much happens. The heart of it is the kids. It's the kids are the nucleus of this. That wasn't the case in this one. They're split apart for most of it. They don't interact. We don't get the fun thing, the nostalgia thing of them being together. You introduce the Max character. She's a good actress. Her brother's a solid actor. They do nothing for the plot. She's just, hey, now let's have a girl crush in there. And it was so, you know, hey, I wonder who got the high score. I wonder who's going to be yay awesome at everything. You know, it's like, because
it's Poochie.
Yeah, like, let's, you know, God forbid we have a female character in here that's got vulnerabilities and is human, and we have to make her struggle to adapt and not just learn to be not. I mean, that was my frustration, was it like she could have been, it was just, I don't know. It was just, I love the idea of bringing in, you know, more characters, and particularly more female characters, et cetera, would be great. But the way it was handled and the side plots, the weirdo with the conspiracy, like at one point we're supposed to think there's a super powerful government conspiracy where they have all the people watching them. And then they just show up at the conspiracist guy's house and spill the beans. And there seems to be no problem there. I like Paul Reiser. I think Paul Reiser as a character was a good addition.
I especially liked it because number one, if you want to draw parallels, season 1 of Stranger Things was the movie Alien, and then season 2 is Aliens. And especially, I loved Paul Reiser as a casting choice because before he was Mad About You, he was the dark betrayer, the guy who screwed over all the Space Marines for corporate greed. And to see him in a place where it's like it's ambiguous. You know, he's got great bedside manner, seems to care about the kids, but also you don't know. It's like they cast him for
you're thinking he's going to be that guy, and then he's a good guy. And I would say that my frustration too was like, you know, the trailers for this were amazing. You know, the big looming you know, spooky monster and thing, and I'm waiting for that stuff to happen and all the things to happen to Hawkins. And I get like, well, wait till season three, but you can't do that. You can't go like, oh, well, this is going to pay off later on, so it's not going to pay off now. And that drives me nuts.
Wait. Hold on. So I only saw the last two episodes. I haven't seen the last two episodes. They don't address or defeat whatever that big thing is.
No, the big thing, right? They defeat the space dogs. The demo dogs.
Oh, but not the big looming thing first half of the season is about.
The looming thing.
You don't understand. He's got to get all of the Infinity Stones, and then he's got the really big, powerful glove.
That's really unfortunate.
They stop the gate. Before he gets out of the gate, you know, so it's like, man, you know, it'd suck if Godzilla just stomped all over Tokyo. Yeah, it would suck if he stomped all over there. What if we put some depth charges in the ocean, just kill him there? Boom, done. Mission solved. Great.
Well, and that to me, the frustrating part about the 11 stuff was that by the end of it, you're like, oh wait, we just had to deal with all this stuff because you couldn't figure out anything to do with her when the ending isn't just, oh, 11 found out there was a problem. Well, 11's just going to solve it. Cool.
Yeah.
We 11's here. She's before she was in the woods, but now she's here and she went on a little trip to figure it out.
I think there could have been so many other, I mean, you start with where is the universe now? What would be the likely thing that would happen after something that happens? One of the reasons I love Dark Knight after Batman Begins is you're like, okay, what's the world like now after you have Batman, you have this? Oh, you get a bunch of other weirdos now, you know, and weirdos you can't even imagine, like the Joker. Stranger Things, too. It's like, all right, yep, every day we just try to seal up this void. No, we're not sending missions and teams into the underneath to see what else is there, which I'd be thinking like, shoot, like you'd be doing like there'd be expeditions and all sorts of other stuff there. And we don't know. And did the Russians ever make it through? Did there was other stuff? Are there bad 11s? Are there other stuff? Like, I think like to me, I'm like, there's so much more interesting, cool stuff other than like, yeah, it's just this weird other dimension. And we have another dimension, but we just keep it in the basement, and just seal it up. I'm like, that does not seem to me like a realistic, you know, way that would be handled, which I thought was frustrating.
And I never really got a sense of like two things that were less powerful for me in this season. Three things. Number one, the lab. Now it's a nice lab. And then we find out that some of the people are still assholes, but Paul Reiser is mad about you. So like he's okay. Number two, Eleven's powers. I feel like, man, I know you got to step up your game a little bit, but the fact that how many nosebleeds were in this?
That one season. For one thing, like I liked the idea of a nosebleed happening under periods of intense strain. And every time in season one that it happened, you know, they were extraordinary events that were happening, but they also make it clear she can handle some little stuff here or there without freaking out.
So do either of you play the game?
No.
No.
I played the game. I enjoyed it. I played the game all the way through, and I really liked the game a lot. And the game, you can play as 11. And I'm like, but I didn't want to use the 11 characters so much because I'm thinking, oh, there's got to be a cost every time she uses the power. No, she just uses the power whenever you want. And I'm like, all right, that's kind of a challenge, you know, as a storytelling thing. But, man, you know, it's as we said before, like the hard part is, you know, Netflix wanted this show and the showrunners had to come out with a show and they had a short amount of time to be able to do this, deliver this. And everybody's telling them what it needs to be and what the answer's to. So I don't blame the showrunners. Not even I blame Netflix. I just blame that, we want this thing fast. We got this thing fast. And some of it was really great. So, you know, we've had that before, like with, you know, True Detective. True Detective season one is an epic, you know, TV changing thing. And then HBO is like, we need to have season two next year. We need to have this thing next year, and we want that. And, you know, when things get rushed, it's problematic. And, you know, our expectations need to be managed.
But ultimately, the thing that I kept coming back to was something that Andrew said before and said just now. The first season was great because the kids solved the problems. The kids were leading the adults. The adults had responsibilities and the life had gotten to them and made them less impetuous and for the sake of our story, less effective because they care about these things and they have these bonds and responsibilities. The kids could just be like, no, let's go here. No, let's go here. No, he's a Demogorgon from D&D. So let's do things to kill a Demogorgon. And now we're on this adventure here. Man, and part of that, though, is understanding that childlike nostalgia of everything is the world, right? The school is your universe. That's where the world ends.
Yeah.
And
path is Mirkwood, you know, becomes all of, you know, The Hobbit. And the scenes with, like, the actors are great. The kid actors are doing great, but you're watching the whole D'Artagnan, the dart thing. You're like, we know what this is. How many episodes do we have to go with this delightful little thing trying to find this thing that's not at all evocative of gremlins or anything else like this? Because we know it's a little evil creature, and we're just waiting.
There was a hot moment I was hoping that that they would have kind of, you know, like their ghost to the rest of the direwolves or whatever. Like, you know, that's a bad example because all of them were good. But basically, like, to have one on their side would have been interesting, and to see this noble sacrifice of you know, like, something that indicated that maybe the savageness could be trained out of them or something.
Well, you got that. You got that at the end where Dart lets them pass.
Yeah, but I think it would have been I don't know. I'm with you in that it was laborious for them to get to the place where they figured out what it was. Once they did, yeah. I think it would have been really interesting if they just had actually connected. If maybe they indicated that our world and the Upside Down weren't as different as we would think at the end of the first season.
Yeah, there was a lot of things.
The positives, though, I thought the actors are still great. That finale, I think, is my favorite episode of the show, and actually, like, in a lot of ways, made me really moderated my tone toward the season, because I think that everything did come together eventually in a really cool and interesting and satisfying way. And Steve is the greatest character on the show, and even when he's losing, he's winning, just getting dumping that dead weight of, you know, what's her butt.
Gentlemen, anything else?
No.
It's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.